lesson is chosen as the subject the Valley of Dry Bones. As we gather, this is going to be slightly different than the usual discourse. So we look to the Lord's blessing and leading on the subject the Valley of Dry Bones, Brother Desmond.
Our subject, the Valley of Dry Bones, is supported by the prophet Ezekiel in the 37th chapter of his prophecy. Now, this is a most remarkable prophecy. It points with accuracy to the nation of Israel. Ezekiel had a most unusual vision, and this is what he experienced. He found himself in a valley, mountains on either side. But what was unusual about this valley is that every place he looked, there were bones laying about. And as he began examining these bones, he noticed that they were very dry and brittle. And as he was examining these bones, he heard a voice asking a question. And immediately Ezekiel recognized that this was the voice of God. And the question that the Lord was asking, he said, "Ezekiel, you see all these dry bones before you? Do you think, Ezekiel, that these bones will ever come to life again?" And Ezekiel hesitated a little bit, and he gave the question right back to the Lord. And he said, "Lord, I can't answer that question. You have the answer. You know what the answer is." And then the Lord commanded the prophet to prophesy thus. And we read, "O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, and ye shall live. I will lay sinews upon you, I will bring up flesh upon you, and cover you with skin, and put breath into you, and you shall live." Ezekiel was obedient, and he uttered this prophecy. And then as he was uttering this particular prophecy, he was startled by a noise. And as he looked around, he noticed that these bones that were silent a moment ago began to rattle and shake. And then he was further surprised when he saw these bones coming together into a human skeleton. That is, the arms began to find their sockets, the legs finding their sockets, and there he began to visualize a skeleton form of a human. And then he was further amazed at the proceedings when these forms of bones began to receive muscle, filling in the empty spaces that were in this bone. And then as he continued to watch, he noticed flesh coming into its place and covering that form. And then the layer of skin completing the human form. And now stood before him, as he could see, a complete form of being. But then as he watched this being, he noticed that it didn't move. It was lifeless. And as Ezekiel stood and he watched, he heard God speaking again. And he says, "Ezekiel, I want you to make another prophecy. And this is what I want you to say. Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain that they might live." And then as he was watching this human form, perfect in every respect except for life, a remarkable thing took place. He saw breath being put into these human forms, and all of a sudden they just stood up and became alive and began to move around. And as Ezekiel watched with awe what was happening right before his eyes, he heard God speaking again. And God said, "Ezekiel, these bones that you see are the whole house of Israel. They have been saying, these bones, lo, our bones are dry, and our hope is lost, and we are cut off. Now Ezekiel, says God, prophesy and say this to them. Behold, O my people, I will open up your graves and cause you to come up and bring you into the land of Israel. And I shall put my spirit into you, and I will place you in your own land, for I am the Lord, I have spoken it. And then the prophet was instructed to do something else. The Lord told Ezekiel that he should take a stick. He says, Ezekiel, take a stick that you see before you, and I want you to write something upon this stick. And I want you to write these words, for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. And after writing this down, the Lord said, Ezekiel, I want you to take another stick. I want you to write something upon that stick. And upon the second stick, Ezekiel, you write this. For Joseph and for all of the house of Israel, his companion. Now, Ezekiel, I want you to take those two sticks and I want you to put them together and make them look like one stick. Now, if someone would ask you, Ezekiel, what this means, these two sticks, and the fact that you put them together, this is the answer. I will make Israel one nation. They shall no more be two nations, neither shall they be divided, but will be under one kingdom, one king. Now there we have the prophecy of Ezekiel concerning this valley of dry bones. Now Bible students for years have focused their telescope of prophecy on the nation of Israel. And through that telescope of prophecy, we have really witnessed a miracle, the rebirth of the nation of Israel. And the regathering of Israel to us as Bible students, to us as God's children, is of extreme importance because it gives us the hour on God's great time clock of the ages. We know exactly where we are on the stream of time. This event also clearly reveals to us that this particular age in which we are living, the gospel age, is about ready to be completed. And it is the opening up of a new age, the age in which mankind will be blessed. Now, in the last few years, an area known as the Middle East has been brought to our attention as never before, especially in the last few months. Our newspapers and our radios have been filled with news concerning this troubled spot of the world, the Mideast. There are wars and threats of wars, the closing of the Suez Canal, invasions, debates, and the resolutions of the UN all have highlighted the problems that exist in this Mideast area. Now, I think it is well for us as Bible students to become acquainted with this area that is a troubled spot in the world today. Just where is it, and what countries are included? It is well for the Bible student of today to become acquainted with the world's geography and the countries and the current history. We should become acquainted with the actors that are playing on this world stage. We have the program. We know what's going to take place. We have the acts before us. But we must become acquainted with the actors, these countries that are playing their particular parts on this world stage. Now, to help you understand this particular area, we've produced this map for you. It is a map of the Mideast. Now, the heart of the Mideast is composed of seven countries. Six of these countries are Arabian, and one is Hebrew, Little Israel itself. Now, the Middle East area is located partly in Africa and some of it in southwestern Asia, and it takes in the entire Arabian Peninsula. Now, this area serves as a huge bridge which links the three great continents of the world: Asia, Africa, and Europe. Especially with the Suez Canal cutting through this land bridge, it increases the strategic importance of this Mideast area. Now let's consider for a moment the size of this Middle East. It's larger than our United States. You take, for instance, Saudi Arabia, it's larger than the size of the United States east of the Mississippi River. Now, Egypt here is also large. That would cover Texas and most of New Mexico. Iraq is larger than California. Iran would swallow up two states of Texas, with Oklahoma included. On the other hand, you have tiny Lebanon, very small. That matches up nicely with the state of Connecticut. And then you have Israel, which is just as large as our little state of Massachusetts. Now, the population of this entire area is concentrated in two countries, in Egypt and Iran. There are a few large cities in this area. For instance, Cairo, Egypt, has some 2.5 million people. Alexandria and Tehran has about 1 million. Aside from that, there are very few cities. Now, the land itself is very dry. Deserts, mountains. In fact, some of these countries are to be some 90% barren or desert land. Nothing will grow. Very few rivers in this area. You have the Tigris and the Euphrates in Iraq, the Nile in Egypt, the Jordan River in Israel, and this, with some wells and a few lakes, is all that the Mideast has to survive on. Now, the economics of this area, we find the countries very poor. The lack of water means the lack of crops and naturally a lack of food. They practically have no coal or iron, no industry to speak of. And throughout the Mideast, everything from a watch to an automobile has to be imported at a staggering cost. Now, most of these countries have in their midst a very small but extremely rich class. And then you have millions upon millions of peasants living in just mud huts or just roaming about along the countryside. In fact, they're born in poverty and they die in poverty. Oil is a basic resource in Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. About a quarter of the free world oil output comes from this area. But this resource of this area is of little help to the population. I think it employs some 150,000 Arabs to work in connection with this industry. You see, the financial backing and the industrial know-how of the United States, the British, the French, and the Dutch is necessary to get that oil out of the ground and to market it properly. And for this, they must share in the profits. And so this Mideast area, as far as the population is concerned, profits very little. Now, all of these countries that you see before you have acquired a new political status since the First World War. Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon were recognized as independent governments from 1920 to 1930. Saudi Arabia was recognized in 1932. Israel became a state in 1948, and Egypt the last one in 1953. Now, most of these countries, are nominally democratic, except for Saudi Arabia, who has a king, King Saud. He owns the country, he owns its oil. And of the $300 million he receives annually from the oil revenue, he runs the government. Now, the Middle East, at this very hour, has three dangerous situations. Number one, Israel. Number two, Egypt and the Suez Canal. Number three, communist domination. Now, of these three, Israel commands our attention. Of all the Middle East countries that we have mentioned, Israel stands on top. It's the most modern nation that there is today. All of the Arab countries actually resent the presence of Israel. Israel, you see, was carved out of the Arab nations, and for this reason, the Arabs have never forgiven the nations of the world for doing that. Neither have they ever recognized Israel as an independent country. We have some with us in political circles who sympathize with Israel. They recognize the need of those people of having their own land. But they have doubts in their minds as to Israel's legal and moral right to the land that they occupy. The Arabs call the creation of Israel as international piracy, that the land was actually stolen from them. And so this afternoon, we would like to present to you Israel's fourfold claim of the land in which they are in. Number one, its biblical claim. Number two, its historical claim. Number three, its claim by international law. And number four, its claim of the land itself. Now the first claim, its biblical claim. And we're going to support that by the prophet Ezekiel. When we turn to the 11th chapter and the 17th verse, we read, "Thus saith the Lord God, I will even gather you from the people, and assemble you out of the countries where ye have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel." Jeremiah 16:15. "I will bring them again into their land, and that I gave to their fathers." Amos 9:15. "And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled out of their land." And you and I have witnessed the modern exodus. Recently, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion said that Israel expects the Jews from Russia. And Russia contains some 2 million Jews. The Polish Jews are leaving in numbers. The Iron Curtain permitted 50,000 Jews to leave. And if you remember, in 1938, there were 3,250,000 Jews in Poland. And at the beginning of this year, only 50,000 left. And by the end of this summer, there will hardly be a Jew left on Polish soil. 16,500 Jews are now on their way from Hungary to Israel. And by 1958, Israel will climb toward the 3 million mark of population in their land. Yes, the Lord said they will be gathered in their land. Now the claim number two, the historical claim. Always, or almost always, since the fall of the Jewish state, some Jews have actually lived in the land of Palestine. The people of Israel have remained an identifiable community for some 3,500 years. And prior to Israel's occupation of Palestine and the former land of Canaan, no single nation owned or occupied that land. Furthermore, Israel has owned and occupied that land as a sovereign state. It never, at any time, surrendered its title to the land. Claim number three, under international law. The foundation documents of Israel's claim under the Law of Nations was the Balfour Declaration. This was a declaration establishing a homeland for the Jewish people. And then if you remember in the year 1919, when there was a peace conference of the nations, the Arab delegation was present. And they approved this Balfour Declaration. And its significance as to how they stamped their approval upon this. Because they closed their approval with these words. They said, "We wish the Jews a most hearty welcome home." They recognized in the year 1919 that this was the home of the Jewish people. And then in 1948, they just removed that welcome mat. And you remember the headlines at that particular time in 1948, where the Arab leaders informed their people that they should leave Palestine, leave their homes, their land, and so on, their property, and to go stay next door to the Arab states around them, because they were afraid that the Arabian army's guns might mow them down. And the Arabians were told that in just a few weeks, we're going to drive the Jews down to the Mediterranean Sea. And that they, that is the Arabians, would then come back and be recipients of all the booty that was left and have all the millions that the Jews had spent on economic development. But history wrote another story. God was writing this history. And you know what had happened? It seemed that overnight that great, wonderful Arabian army just crumbled up. And when this was known, panic resulted among all the Arabians. And they began to just stampede across the borders in every direction. And the big landlords and the big mayors, the wealthy merchants, the government officials, the doctors and the lawyers were the first ones to flee. It seemed that the whole structure of Arab society just crumbled overnight. However, those that remained in Palestine, and some did at the request of the Israeli government, have full rights as citizens in Palestine. And further, Israel compensated all who had lost their land, their homes, as a result of these hostilities. Israel also bought land from the Arabs, just as the Bible said they would. Some 250,000 acres were purchased from the Arabs. We're also told that the money that the Arabs had in the bank deposits, they're being paid to them by Israel. And this amounts to some $8 million. And we believe that Israel has assumed her responsibility toward these Arabian refugees who had to make way for the Israelites. But the guilty ones in this sad state of affairs, I believe, are the Arab states. The Arab nations have made a political football out of this tragedy of some 900,000 refugees who lost their homes when Israel became a nation. But the point is that the Arab nations refuse to cooperate with this dilemma because they might lose their political leverage over Israel. Now, half of those Arabian refugees are under 15 years of age. They have no real roots in Israel at all. And you take the country of Iraq, which isn't too far away. There's a country that's rich in potential productive capacity, and they're well able to absorb every Arabian refugee, and it would be beneficial not only to the country of Iraq, but even to the refugees. But the Arabs refuse to take in their Arabian brethren because they'd like to get rid of Israel as a nation. Now the fourth claim, the claim of the land itself. On each occasion when they were driven into exile, the Jews left behind a fertile land. And when they began to return in large numbers in the 19th century, they came to those ancient hills, and every place they looked, there was erosion. All plant life was gone. The watered areas that they left were now just swamps. But then, when they did return, a wonderful transformation took place. And the UN Special Committee on Palestine had this to say concerning that transformation when they made the report, and I quote, "The Jews have brought to agriculture in Palestine both capital and skill, which together have had a profound effect on the country, transforming it from waste and neglect to fruitful ground, so that it may be truly said that they have made the desert to blossom as a rose." Jewish industry and capital have put immense wealth into an otherwise worthless land. And now for the next few minutes, we're going to show you actually the tremendous strides that have been made in Israel by way of colored slides. And so we'll have the lights doused, and we will continue our presentation. The land is slowly being transformed because of this modern miracle of irrigation. The engineers have built up these special ducts through which the lifeline runs water for these parched lands. Another picture of the irrigation project. The land needs much water. This is a typical farm in Israel. Notice it being placed right in the valley. Water is present. And when you combine water and earth and the sun, you have plants growing. And that's exactly what's happening in a land that at one time was just barren with nothing growing upon it. Again, you have a picture of the beautiful Jordan Valley. Every inch of space is used in Israel. Here you have goat herders taking care of their flocks. This land is stony in some parts, but they discover that this stone, if it is ground up, produces a fertilizer that is very beneficial to the land. We're also told not far from this place that they had discovered millions of tons of peat, which is an organic fertilizer, which is very beneficial to the land of Israel. And, of course, you have the little Israelites growing up, and they're enjoying the beach all to themselves. Not far from this place that you are viewing, the copper mines of Solomon are being worked. And these mines, after being investigated, have the reserve of copper estimated to be 100,000 tons. And here you have the hills of Nazareth, the boyhood place of our Lord. Now, the mineral wealth of the Dead Sea is difficult to estimate. Millions of tons of potash and bromine are waiting to be excavated from the Dead Sea. And at present, Israel has constructed a $10 million chemical plant. And it is in operation today, and it is extracting the minerals from the Dead Sea. And I think that the Dead Sea may still have some precious and rare material that many nations may desire to have, and that may cause this trouble to break out. They may try to obtain that particular material by force. Well, that concludes the picture story of our nation of Israel. And you and I have witnessed this great drama which actually happened before our eyes since 1948. And so we're able to see, through the prophet Ezekiel, these dry bones coming to life. We have seen the sinews filling in the empty spaces. We've seen the muscle fill in the other spaces, and then we've seen the layer of skin. But there's one thing lacking, and that is we haven't as yet seen the breath, the Spirit of the Lord, go into those bones, as it were. But before they receive life from God, this life-giving breath, they have to do one thing that they're not doing today. And that is to acknowledge Jehovah in all its ways. Today they're trusting in their might, how strong they are, how strong their army is. And it's Israel all the time, not God. And the time God will intervene is revealed by Ezekiel when he says, when Israel will dwell safely, then will the enemy strike. And that time hasn't arrived as yet. Israel still is in a continual danger of being attacked. Every day we have skirmishes of little attacks on the sidelines. However, when the period of dwelling arrives, when Israel will begin to feel, well, finally we've overcome all of the obstacles, now we can really enjoy peace, we can enjoy the security that we have made, it is then that the prophet Ezekiel says, just as lightning coming out of the sky, the enemy, the destroyer, will come from the north to attack. And it is then that God will reveal himself in one form or another, not only to Israel, his people, but to the world. It is then that he's going to fight for his people as he did in the days of old. And it is then that's going to mark the beginning of this kingdom which we're praying for. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And it is then that these blessings will begin to flow to Israel and the world of mankind.
Certainly one of the great miracles of our time
has been unfolding day by day as we have watched the experiences of God's chosen people. Let us close this meeting with the use of hymn number 216. We'll sing the first and the last stanza. Arise the last stanza, and we'll ask Brother Jesuit to not only close this meeting with prayer, but also ask the Lord's blessing upon the business meeting that will follow immediately thereafter. 216.
Obedient.